I'm the Right Reverend Sean Manchester, an autocephalous bishop in the One Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church, who is best known for carrying out exorcisms. People do know me as best as the composite person I am, and principally through my public persona, which is largely television and film. I'm exactly the sort of bishop that people were used to for millennia until the liberal, non-believing type emerged in the largely in the nonconformist and Anglican churches, where you had a position in the 90s, as recorded in the Times newspaper, where at least 90 bishops in the Church of England did not believe in the existence of God. Like Montague Summers, of whom few had heard anything until recent decades, I began in the Church of England, chiefly as a choir boy and the head of a boys' church, and converted to Roman Catholicism under Pope Pius XII, so pre-Vatican II, when things were still very traditional, and became disenchanted when they ceased to hold fast to the ways that had gone prior for centuries and threw the baby up with the bathwater as the signposts fell down. My spiritual odyssey is quite involved, but it led eventually to me entering holy orders in an autocephalous Catholic jurisdiction, which is not under the universal jurisdiction of the Pope.
Can you just tell us what this word autocephalous means?
It means not under the supervision of an organisation such as the Vatican.
And would you compare your progress through the churches, various churches, to Montague?
It's very similar, in so much as Montague Summers began in the Church of England. He identified very much with the Roman Catholic Church, probably more than I do. I mean, he was ultramontane. I mean, he was exceptionally Catholic. But again, although he was diaconated in the Roman Church, as he had been also in the Church of England, his priestly orders were in the Old Catholic Church in its traditional manifestation.
Many people in Bristol have not even heard of Montague Summers, even though he lived in Clifton. So can you tell us who he was?
The Right Reverend Alphonsus Joseph Mary Augustus Montague Summers. Fascinating character, without whom vampirological and indeed demonological research would have been very much the poorer. He was certainly a vampirologist of what some have believed to be, though not I, inquestionable orders. His orders, as far as I am concerned, were absolutely legitimate and valid. Indeed, I know what his apostolic succession is, and that he was consecrated variously. For example, in March 1946, he was appointed nuncio for Great Britain. He'd been consecrated for the Order of Corporate Reunion in June 1927 by Bishop Dominic Albert Godwin. But very few, I don't think any biographers that I'm aware of or writers on Summers seem to be aware of these facts. Maybe it's because they're outside the ecclesiastical perspective. But I share many similarities to Summers' career insofar as I began in Anglicanism, converted to Roman Catholicism, and ended up, as did Summers, in an independent Catholic jurisdiction to hang on to the old traditions. I mean, he was undoubtedly, as some have described myself, a throwback to an earlier age, an unreconstructed Jacobite, one might say, longed for the restoration of Catholic England.
Now, you may say that, but, I mean, what's the problem with the Protestant Church? I mean, many people believe that the whole idea of the Pope being almost like God's representative on earth, the infallibility, this kind of thing, was what Protestants were overthrowing. So wasn't that actually a positive move?
Moving away from Summers for the moment, if we go back to Henry VIII and that era, they regarded themselves as Catholics. They broke away from Rome and the universal jurisdiction of the Pope, but they still regarded themselves very much as Catholics. Indeed, traditional Anglicans today regard themselves as Catholics. They describe themselves as not Roman, but English Catholics. This is what is misunderstood by so many people, quite apart from the fact that there are many Catholic churches apart from the Roman Catholic Church. There's Eastern Catholic. I mean, if you were in Iraq, for example, you'd be in the Chaldean Catholic Church, which, as it happens, is in full communion with Rome, but is independent of Rome. And there are many other Eastern Catholic churches.
Do you think it's fair to compare you and Monty in that both of you were aware that the traditional Church of England was not really believing in Christ? Because that's quite a strong challenge to make.
Well, my experience with the Church of England, which in my early years was quite intimate, found most answers from the minister being, well, it's fine, you can believe that if you want, or you don't have to believe it if you don't want. And I found this wishy-washy attitude to principal matters of doctrine unacceptable. I mean, Summers is quite explicit, as am I, that the matters in Holy Scripture, in doctrine, are not negotiable. They're not up for discussion. You can reject them, of course, but you cannot meddle with them and say, I'll take that but not that, and I don't like the sound of that. Either it is part of Holy Writ and what was decided upon by the faithful, the early church, the church fathers, and the ecumenical councils. Either it is so or it is not.
But now, I mean, the Church of England would argue that what they're doing is they're putting a little bit of spin on the Bible in order to really make Christianity more appealing to people.
Well, I mean, Christianity is not a popularity club, and it is not supposed to be appealing to people. People are supposed to search and find the truth, and Christianity proffers the truth. I believe it's scripturally the case that it will always be a minority, and I would rather have a small church of true believers than a vast monolithic organization of heretics and those that believe whatever they want to believe. I mean, there are groups within the various churches like the Church of England who clearly don't believe in anything whatsoever. Everything's explained away by psychology, and I mean, I can't understand why they become ordained in the first place. Not that their ordinations are regarded as valid by Roman and Eastern churches, but I mean, the fact is that they'd be better doing social work or something of that sort, because faith doesn't seem to enter into it. And those genuine Christians who are in the priesthood and the laity of the, for example, Anglican Church, who hold fast to the true doctrines, they regard themselves very much as Catholics. Not Roman, but they do regard themselves as Catholics.
So are you implying that there are fake Christians out there for wearing the reverence dog collar and the bishop's hats?
There are people who claim to be Christian, whether they're ordained or otherwise, who do not hold to Christian doctrine and non-negotiable statements in the Bible, particularly the New Testament, and don't even accept the resurrection as a fact, don't accept the miracles as really having happened in the material sense of the word, and much else besides, and question the whole concept of God the Father, and see that as something to be taken poetically and not to be taken literally. So, yes, I would say these people are not truly Christian, as would, of course, Montagu Summers. To get back to Summers, he would have regarded them as heretics.
So what was Montagu's major work, and do you think it's still important today?
Montagu Summers was such a fascinating character in himself and his journey that it almost eclipses the more mundane aspects of being an ordained priest and latterly, in his case, as in mine, consecrated bishop, which fewer even still people seem to be aware of, therefore representing the body of Christ, the church. I mean, there are many priests and bishops. There are few today, at least, and even in his time, there were not that many who accepted what had been accepted for centuries in terms of the supernatural phenomena, whether it's the miraculous or the demonic. I mean, a lot of people have said that he said these things and wrote these things and believed in these things for effect, but that's not how I see it. He struck me as being, and strikes me as being, extremely devout, and there are reasons why he became so, I believe, but his prose was solemn, archaic, and often impenetrable, nevertheless written with an energy, a conviction that carries the reader, as you've discovered yourself, forward, which makes it impossible almost to put his books down. He was no skeptic, and he didn't make the claims he made for effect or because it was more exciting. He absolutely, as I do, believed that the dark tales he shared with his readers were true, and that such demonic manifestations as vampires, for example, and those who are damned to be transformed into wolves through occultic means, really happen. Indeed, not believing in such things, according to him, was akin to heresy or worse. These things are not disorders of the mind, but of the soul. And you won't find too many priests, fewer still in the Anglican Church today, saying these things.
Now, well, many people today would put these sorts of things down to mental health disorders.
Yes, indeed. But that doesn't satisfy the person aware that there are, of course, mental disorders, many, but there are also demonic interferences and possessions and even manifestations. And it seems like the Christian Church was very much aware of that, as were the writers of the Bible. I mean, the New Testament writers describe demonic possession, but they also describe epilepsy and epileptics. They didn't mix the two. So they were aware that there was a distinction, and that that mental disorder did exist and other disorders did exist, as well as demonic possession.
So what would you say to convince anybody, if you can, that Montague's work is still important today?
Well, I don't have to say very much. I mean, if we were talking back in the 50s, even the early 60s, I'd have to say quite a lot to even convince them of who he was. I think the earliest media sort of reference to Montague Summers is in the John le Carré film with Richard Burton and Claire Bloom, The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, where Claire Bloom is running an occult bookshop in Museum Street. There actually was one there. Whether it's still there or not, I don't know. But in fact, they used that as a location. And she refers to Montague Summers' work, I think, The Werewolf, I think that one. But anyway, that was the first reference to him. And most people, well, almost everybody, would have wondered who on earth he was. By that time, I'd read quite a few of his books. Indeed, I became acquainted with his works on vampirism even before I was a teenager. So that was unusual. And mention of him would have raised an eyebrow or two. And as he did in his own life, I mean, he was such a fascinating character. He was kind, courteous, witty, but he also carried with him a sense of underlying discomfort and mystery. My colleague actually met him at least twice. He describes him as very tall, well, tall at least, with flowing silver hair, plump, round-cheeked, and generally smiling, but his dress code resembled that of an 18th-century cleric, with a few additional flourishes. He wore sweeping black capes, crowned with a curious hairstyle of his own devising. So peculiar was his hairstyle that many assumed he wore a wig. His voice was unusually high-pitched, comical even, and often in complete contrast to the macabre tales he was in the habit of recounting.
The way that many people nowadays come across the term vampire is when you're talking about people who are energy vampires, who, you know, you're actually in their presence for a while and you feel like your energy is just drained. Now, can you just explain what that means and what the difference between, you know, a traditional vampire and an energy vampire
is? The difference is the English language. One is a noun, the other is a description. yes, the word vampire can be used adjectivally to describe a bat that sucks blood, or to describe a person who apparently or seemingly at least drains energy. In some cases, maybe even blood, in the case of, as they curiously describe themselves, sanguines. That is to say, living people who have some fetish for blood, and either with or without the agreement of the donor, take it. But these are not vampires, although some people seem to think they are, but that again might be a mental disorder in their case. They certainly aren't. They have an obsession. It could be born out of various things. It is only in the vampiroidic sense, or vampophiles have only really existed in relatively recent times. I would say the last three decades, maybe less, maybe a quarter of a century. You don't find any before then, apart from psychotic murderers who had a necrophilic desire for blood. These cults of groups, clubs, societies, where youngsters in the main gather to dress up and, in some cases, take blood of each other, they have nothing whatsoever to do with the real phenomenon of vampirism, nor do psychic vampires, as they would have you believe them to be, who seemingly drain the energy, or so they say, of their intended victims. There are people who appear, I mean, Aleister Crowley seemed to have this effect. As I've known people who knew Montagu Summers, I've known people who knew his contemporary, Aleister Crowley, the Edwardian Satanist. And I remember a lady who ran a bookshop. She said she passed him on the stairs once, and it made her physically sick. By the time she descended the stairs, she was absolutely ill. He had this terrible aura about him. And he was very interested in psychic vampirism. In fact, he was interested in all forms of vampirism. One of the reasons he met Montagu Summers, I think they met no more than twice in their lives. And of course, Aleister Crowley died only a short period of months before Montagu Summers in 1948. It was when Summers died. The reason Aleister Crowley wanted to meet Montagu Summers was because of the publication of one of the vampire books. I believe it might have been the first, The Vampire's Kith and Kin, because Crowley himself was into that aspect. And of course, vampirism is a dark and sinister area and aspect, which involves, the real vampire, of course, is a manifestation which is at root and source demonic. Various people in the past, both Protestant and Catholic, have offered different theories. King James, who wrote Demonology, as well as translating the Bible, he wrote a work called Demonology, in which he proposes that a vampire is a demon masquerading as a dead body, come back from beyond the grave, and convincing people that he is the actual person. Others, no less qualified, in fact, priests in the Catholic Church and Eastern Orthodox churches, have gone further and said, no, although it is obviously in demonic control, the manifestation is an actual body, not a natural body, but a supernatural body, which is in corporeal form and invested with supernatural ability. Hence, it can leave the grave without disrupting the earth, and so forth and so on. Now, this is what Montagu Summers believed in. Whether or not you use the term as an adjective to describe people who seem to sap your energy when you walk into the room with them, that's fine, but that's not a vampire in the real sense. Now, in the real sense, it's a noun.
Well, one of the things that really is implied here is that there is this kind of demonic world of angels, demons, and a spirit world. Do you actually have any evidence for the existence of this kind of parallel world?
My only evidence is evidence of my own experience and the experience of those with me at the time, or close to me, or other people's experiences. I mean, there is no evidence for the supernatural beyond personal experience. I mean, where's your evidence of the miracles of the Christ, of the saints? Where is your evidence of the resurrection? but you believe it if you're a Christian, because that is what a Christian is defined as believing.
So in what way have you experienced that world?
Like Montague Summers, I have encountered the world of demons, largely because my ministry of exorcism has been well established down the years and busy. And I suppose was thrown into the deep end in the 60s, mid-60s. And by the end of that decade, was already well and truly entrenched in my first major case. But because I've confronted such supernatural phenomena, as claimed also Montague Summers, I am in no doubt that it exists. I find it difficult to misinterpret what happened or explain it away some other way. The fact is that I have priests as well as laity in other denominations and churches approaching me on a fairly regular basis, largely because they have no idea how to deal with this phenomena when it is brought to their attention by one of their parishioners or somebody, because they're no longer, as they are supposed to be, exorcists. It's a very highly specialized area, whereas all priests should be trained in exorcism. To not be is a serious lapse, because Christians generally are told in Mark, believers will cast out demons in my name. Now, that is Christ speaking. Believers will cast out demons in my name. Now, if you are a believer, that is what you will do if the situation arises. Of course, one has to then discern between what is a demon and what is not. I haven't found it too difficult. I mean, I've met lots of mentally disturbed people who believed they were possessed, and as far as I was concerned, weren't. I've met people who believe they are vampires, largely on television programs I've been a guest on, and they are not. A demonic manifestation is very different to a natural occurrence. And although one has to test these things, of course, particularly if an area, a house, a place is believed to be haunted or possessed, one has to test it by excluding all natural possibilities. But where I've confronted the real malign supernatural, the dark demonic world, the nether region, I've been left in no doubt what I'm dealing with. And the extraordinary circumstances require extraordinary means to rectify and remedy them. And these are the opinions also of Montague Summers, who wrote prolifically on the subject. I'm so heartened that my good friend and colleague, somewhat older than I, Peter Underwood, was able to, after a lively exchange of correspondence, visit Montague Summers toward the end of his life at his home on Richmond Green, no longer in Bristol. He discovered a kindly man who did much to awaken his interest in the occult and the supernatural. I think Peter mentioned to Summers that he was looking into a vampire case himself, and on the second visit to the elderly clergyman, now it would seem in semi-retirement, he went back to seek advice on that vampire case he was following, and to his astonishment, no doubt, Summers blessed and gave him a medallion for protection against vampires, a heavy brass object dating back to the 17th century of Eastern European origin. It also came with assurances from Summers that it had been successfully employed in many vampire cases. Including those recounted in his book, The Vampire's Kith and Kin.
One of the things that Prince Charles has said is he's supposed to be descended from the original Vlad the Impaler. Do you think that there's a possibility? I mean, he's visited the where Vlad the Impaler came from, Count Dracula, supposedly, several times.
Yeah, I think we're confusing a historical figure with a novelistic anti-hero on which possibly Stoker might have based his character. But Vlad Tepes, who is the person you're referring to, of Transylvania and Wallachia, present-day Romania, was a tyrant and somebody whom that side of the royal family, Prince Charles, are certainly, and the Queen, are certainly descended, no question about that, but they're not descended from a vampire, they're descended from a very bloody tyrant who engaged in mass murder and particularly horrendous methods of torture, as was common, I no doubt, in medieval times, and who might have provided some of the grist and grit to Bram Stoker's most excellent novel. But here we're entering the area of fiction, although Stoker did, of course, acquaint himself with vampire lore, L-O-R-E, and before writing his novel. And so there is much in Dracula which is founded on folklore from actual cases. But the story itself and the count and so on and so forth is quite fictional. Vlad Tepes isn't, but it's simply an inspiration for Stoker at best.
What about modern-day Freemasonry and the Orange Order? Do you think we should take an interest in these organisations, and what are they really about? The Illuminati. Now, many people think that there's no such thing, and obviously Freemasonry is around. Can you just give us what your view is of the various theories about these organisations, as you've someone that's studied this whole world much more than many of us?
Well, I don't have theories. I have knowledge and information, which is a dangerous thing if shared incorrectly and inappropriately. In a nutshell, one has to view that whole secret world, Masonic world, if you will, as a pyramid, and at the apex is what has been described and still is described as the Illuminati, which is the highest. I mean, it's sufficient to say that most people are in craft masonry, first 3 degrees of Freemasonry, and they would be, as is the intention, completely in the dark of anything that follows. So they wouldn't have any idea of even the next stage, Royal Arch Masonry, and what they're actually worshipping, the ineffable name of Yabalon. They would have no idea even at that stage. So how much less would they know about 33 degree Scottish Rite Masonry and beyond, and how much less even all of those would know about the very pinnacle, the very height of that pyramid that is the all-controlling Illuminati. But to discuss such things is like discussing archaic languages with somebody who is barely literate, and therefore I don't encourage this sort of conversation in such an open way, because it's rather like vampires. If they don't exist, you've nothing to worry about, and you can do whatever you want and nothing will happen to you. But if they do, you need to take a care. If demons exist, and the vampire is merely a predatory demon manifesting corporeal form, but if they do exist, you need to respect that fact and act accordingly. If the Illuminati and all that is below it in Masonic terms don't exist, there is nothing to fear, is there? But if they do, you need to really be very careful. Very careful indeed.
Now, if anyone's listening and has got a little bit nervous, where's the best place to turn? And maybe there may be some good literature.
Do you know, down the years, I mean, I did my first public broadcast in 42 years ago. And one of the things, and it happens all the time on Facebook and goodness knows where, I'm approached by folk who say, how do I become a vampire hunter? How do I become an exorcist, a demon? And basically, by the nature of what they're asking and by the nature of their phraseology, I My answer is you don't. Leave well alone. No, no, any more than you would take hold of an electric cable that's got hundreds of thousands of volts. You do not dabble in this area. So these people who want to dabble in the world of the occult and the malign supernatural, all I can say is do not do it. Those who are equipped, trained and seasoned to do it, and if you wish to go through the arduous process and are devout enough, fine, that's, but you will find a way, or the way will find you, perhaps. But the, I mean, I personally was thrown in the deep end at a fairly young age, in my 20s, and I was thrown into the deep end, and it confronted me, therefore I had to manage it in some way.
But for many people, they feel that there is some sort of influence in their lives or their family's lives or the lives of their friends. And you seem to be implying that it's not necessarily the best thing to do just simply to turn to your local vicar.
Well, not if he's, as many are, incapable and incompetent. Almost every other day, people say, "Oh, will you bless this crucifix and will you bless this... St. Michael sigil or medallion for me?" And I explain to them, if I do it, it's a meaningless gesture unless your faith matches what we're discussing. I mean, without faith, these items are meaningless crutches that you might as well not bother to have in the first place. And they're only points of focus anyway. They're there to focus your concentration at a moment of need. But if you're brandishing these items, these holy objects and Christian images, if you're brandishing them in the hope that they of themselves will protect you, you're wasting your time. A bit like the protection medallion that was given to Peter Underwood, who very kindly informed me quite recently that he has bequeathed it to me. Without the faith that is invested in that medallion, there really is no point. It's an interesting item. It depicts a knight with a Celtic cross on one side and a torch on the other. On the other side, it shows someone bearing a sword in one hand and a pointed stake in the other. But the interesting thing is the Celtic cross, because all my life I've always used the Celtic cross as a symbol from my teenage years. The equidistant Celtic cross has been something I've always used as a personal symbol. And it turns out that, and I wouldn't have known, I hadn't met Peter Underwood at that time, he first mentioned the medallion, in fact, in an anthology in which I was invited to contribute toward, called The Vampire's Bedside Companion, and one chapter by Peter, I wrote another chapter, and our mutual friend Dr. Devendra Prasad Varma wrote yet another, and he mentioned this medallion, and little did I know all these years later, I mean, that's back in the 70s, early 70s, I would be its eventual recipient. So from Summers comes to Peter Underwood the medallion, and from Peter Underwood it is to be left to me. And so there's the connection. And, of course, my most popular work in print, the Highgate Vampire, is dedicated by me to the memory of Montague Summers. So everything comes to full circle.
Can I come back to the question, where do listeners turn if they feel that they're not getting a serious consideration of what they believe is some kind of occult problem from
right.
the vicar? Where do they turn?
They need to seek out and be in contact with a traditionalist priest who is au fait with the means to deal with their particular problem. So he would need to be proficient in exorcism, and he would need to be acquainted with the workings of these things. And if their own local priest is not, as most likely is the case, they need to ask him to refer them, as you might when you go to your GP and he has to refer you to a consultant because he's just not able to deal with your problem. Likewise, they need to go to their local minister or priest and ask to be referred. And it's very likely that that referral will take them to a traditionalist-minded person who would nevertheless have to have the permission of his bishop in order to actually carry out an exorcism. All the churches I believe it's required that a priest cannot take it upon himself to administer the rituale, or Romanum, to exercise in the traditional ancient and approved way.
With Montague Summers, which of his books would you most recommend on this subject, the spirit world or witchcraft?
Yes, you know, it's very difficult because Montague Summers, who translated the Malleus Maleficarum, was quite extreme in a way perhaps that I'm not. I mean, in his day, the Witchcraft Act still obtained. It hadn't been done away with as it was in the early 50s. But he wanted to destroy the early 18th century Witchcraft Act, which had been somewhat revised. He believed in dealing with them in the way that they are dealt with in the Hammer of the Witches book. So my interest in Summers was really his writings on the vampire, the werewolf, and to some extent witchcraft and black magic. But most people, whether they're reading the history of witchcraft or the geography of witchcraft, another one he wrote, I think they will have some trouble coming to terms with his position on it, because to say it's politically incorrect is putting it mildly. He was fascinated, even obsessed by these things, but he is consistently hostile in a way which most people would find very illiberal today.
We're in a situation with a sort of Harry Potter resurgence in interest in this topic, and actually quite a lot of people would argue that there's really nothing wrong with white witchcraft at all, that it's the black magic that people need to watch out for.
Yes, well, that's a position of pure ignorance, isn't it? The fact is that even the phrase white witchcraft is of itself a complete contradiction of terms. How can you have white witchcraft? I mean, when I speak of witchcraft, I'm speaking in the biblical sense, in the sense that witchcraft has always been understood to be how it was understood in medieval times and before, not in this quasi-feminist movement of New Agers who are usually vegetarian and wear sandals. But I don't think these people are anything to do with witchcraft. Now, they might call themselves that, but this business with Wicca, a modern creation, a modern invention, has nothing to do with witchcraft whatsoever.
Well, what's the purpose of it, then?
Oh, you must ask them. I think it's because they want a pagan alternative to organized religion. They don't want Christianity or any of the other monotheistic religion. They want something which they think is a little bit more interesting and exciting, and are willing to open doors without realizing what's entering. But these people are not really witches in the real meaning of the word. And white witchcraft, I mean, what is white witchcraft? If one is to define what witchcraft is, worship and evocation of what Christians would regard as demons and demonic entities, they wouldn't necessarily, that is to say, the Wiccans. But, I mean, real black magicians, Satanists, diabolists, ceremonial magicians, ritual magicians, they would have nothing but pure contempt for people who... in fact, I wrote a book called From Satan to Christ, in which I describe a young girl's fascination with witchcraft during her immediate postgraduate period, and she joins a witchcraft coven in London and slowly realizes that the secrets, I mean, after her initiation into the 3 degrees of witchcraft, she begins to realize that, of course, it is something altogether more sinister, and the secrets about which they all keep talking are really hardcore Satanism. I mean, I've met lots of witches. I've known some of the most famous witches of my time. And there's no question about it that behind closed doors, what they're really about is what you would call black magic. They don't use those terms. I mean, they use a complete different vocabulary. But what they're really describing, what they're doing, is nothing short of diabolism, sorcery.
You talk about the 3 degrees of witchcraft, but, I mean, that's something we normally associate with Freemasonry, isn't it?
Yes, because witchcraft in its present-day manifestation is born out of Freemasonry. I mean, the originator of the modern witchcraft craze, which goes no further back than the turn of the 20th century, goes back to Gerald Gardner, who, again, immensely influenced by Aleister Crowley, whom he knew. And Gardner, apart from being a pervert, was very much influenced by Hinduism. He spent time out in the East and engaged in all sorts, like Crowley did, sexual experiments and sexual perversions, and was obsessed with nakedness. And he, more or less, is the founding father of modern-day witchcraft. And he was a high-ranking Freemason. And Crowley himself was a Freemason. And so they adapted the first 3 degrees that really most Freemasons only ever receive. They don't ever usually go any further than that. It's the base of the pyramid and therefore the largest area of members. And he adapted those 3 degrees of craft masonry to the craft, witchcraft. And look, there are good and bad people in every organization and none. I mean, there are some pretty sinister people in the church. There are decent people, no doubt, who are Freemasons and who think they are witches. You can't judge them by their mistakes or taking a turning which has involved them in a certain area, which of itself is perhaps a little bit left-hand path, hence the Latin term sinister. So there's good and bad in all walks, and I'm sure there are some really lovely people who describe themselves as witches. But that's not what witchcraft means, any more than the word vampire means people who drain your energy, unwittingly or not, when you enter a room. It's simply use of the term. The term witchcraft is known. I mean, Summers is close to knowing what witchcraft is about. And if you read what he has to say about it, then you're getting much closer to what it's about. But in the modern sense, what I've discovered is that many very dangerous and diabolical groups use witchcraft as a training period to see if somebody's able to be taken further. So if they're not, they never really discover the secrets, and they find a way to discourage them.
So how would they make a decision like that somebody is able to...
It's a slow process. I explain it in From Satan to Christ. What happens is they engage them in what at first seem innocuous ceremonies and activities of nudity and a little bit of bloodletting, maybe, mixing blood with wine and so forth, which the average sort of acolyte isn't really put off by. But slowly but surely, it's a very gradual process of introducing something a little bit further. Then they start to introduce animal sacrifice. Now, at that point, many will balk. Many will be turned off. And then it'll be explained to them at some point, maybe you're not quite the right person for this coven, this group, this order. And they will leave. But they use such techniques of manipulation that what they try and do is make the person feel guilty if they don't participate. And they get them to participate to sufficient a degree where they have something by which they can be blackmailed. Therefore, they have involved themselves in maybe illegal activities, maybe animal sacrifice, maybe rituals in a graveyard which were profane and totally illicit, maybe disturbing a church, similarly at the altar, to get hold of the host, to use it in a consecrated wafer in a way which would be blasphemous. Now, they would just find a way to involve them where they could hold that over them, saying, well, you've come this far, you might as well, you know, if it was found that you were engaged in this sort of thing, and we have the evidence that you were, you know, they will then participate further. I mean, unsurprisingly, in the modern witchcraft covens, they're very, shall we say, liberal on matters of not just perversion, but sexual activity. And you discover in some covens a high degree of prostitution. And that is, in some cases, a form of earnings or income for that coven. It can be quite organized.